Most of us start drawing as kids. Maybe it's superheroes, dinosaurs, or skull and bones and pirates like I used to draw. We do it because it's fun, because we've got these wild ideas bouncing around in our heads, and we want to see them come to life onto paper. Art, at its very core, seems to always begin out of pure curiosity and wonder. But things change as we get older. Once we hit adulthood, we're told it's time to think about a real career, and suddenly art becomes something else. It becomes a task, a pressure. If you go to art school, you're constantly being critiqued. You start comparing yourself to everyone around you, and you push yourself so hard that you lose that sense of wonder that got you to start art in the first place. But here's the thing. If you can quit all of that adult nonsense, you can find a way to get back to the kid version of yourself that would draw just for fun, just to get the ideas out. You might create something better than you have in a long time. Something real and something honest. I'm your host, Jacob Johnson, and this is the Mired is Real podcast, a narrative journey into the lives that shape art. Today's episode, episode 56, Victoria Nunley, right after the break. This podcast is made possible by you, the listener. If you enjoy this show, please consider showing your support on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/miredisreal. I'm constantly uploading bonus clips and other content on there for you to enjoy. These are bonus clips that didn't quite make the final cut of the episodes, and they're still very interesting, very insightful content about artists dealing with creative blocks, balancing work and life, and just other incredible details that I know you want to hear. If you would like to collect some prints from artists featured on the show, head on over to miredisreal.com. You can collect limited edition art prints that not only are supporting me and the show, but is also supporting the artist as well. Thank you so much for listening, and back to the episode.
My name is Victoria V. Nunley. I currently live just south of Washington, D.C. in Alexandria, and I'm a painter.
And is that where you grew up?
No, I grew up in New Jersey. With, as this goes on and I get a little bit more animated, you'll be able to hear probably the accent a little bit.
So where in New Jersey were you from?
Well, until I was 7, I lived in Piscataway, which is sort of near the Rutgers, New Brunswick campus. So there's people, places, things. But there was like sort of a problem with gangs starting in the public middle schools in the area, and some like pretty horrifying violent crimes, like kind of close to where we lived. You know, my dad, who grew up in a bad part of Staten Island, was kind of like, well, we could send our children to private school, but that still doesn't remove them from the environment that we're in. Or we could pay the same amount of money and literally just move across the state to a rural area with good public schools and far less crime. So that's what we did. We moved to the woods. It was very confusing because I'd never really been to an area like that, except when we were visiting my great grandma in upstate New York, you know? So we moved to Lebanon Township, New Jersey, which is just a township.
And was that a big deal for you to move away from the city?
I remember we moved there and I was like, wow, there are so many trees. And then I was like, where are the sidewalks? There aren't any. Where are the traffic lights? There aren't any. Every morning we would hear the across the street neighbor. And by across the street, I mean like a couple acres away, several acres away, hear a rooster. I thought that only happened in cartoons. I was like, we're being awoken by a rooster, a cockle-doodle-dooing every morning. It was wild. It was wild as a 7-year-old.
Victoria's parents were pretty young when they had her and her brother. My parents were super young when they had me as well. I mean, Victoria and I look around at our lives now, and just the thought of being the age our parents were when they had kids seems extremely stressful.
I think because my parents, even though they were young, you know, they were ready to be parents. They were, I think a lot of times when you have young parents, unfortunately, it can be because, you know, maybe they think that's what they should be doing by getting married, or somebody's pregnant or something. But My parents very much were, I don't know, they met, they fell in love. They were like, there's a whole story around that we won't get into, but everybody just know it was the 80s. So there's pleather and big hair involved. And my dad had an ear piercing on one side. So it was of a lightning bolt, the earring. We don't have time to get into it.
Now imagine raising kids while you're going to college. That's got to be a whole different level of stress.
My dad was a plumber and a landscaper at the time, but he put himself through college when I was a kid. So in third grade, I think, we went to his college graduation, and then there was a huge party, you know, where everybody came over, and it was a super big deal. Obviously. So the other thing too, sort of to tie it back to us moving, that move was made possible because my dad was putting himself through school and getting like jobs as, oh God, I'm going to mess this up. I don't think it's computer programming, but it is something to do with computers. I might have been programming actually, but we transcended like two income classes, you know, so we were, I never noticed as a kid, but looking back and my parents talking about it, like we were very, very poor. My mom's father, my grandpa, helped them out a lot. And that's one of the reasons my dad went back to school, because he was just like, we can't keep doing this. Like, this is not possible.
Looking back, things always seemed more stable or less stressful. But in reality, our parents were just probably really good at hiding the hard times from us.
My dad, like, really, really, he wasn't home a lot. And I was talking to my brother about this. We didn't realize that growing up, though, because when he was home, he really made that time count with us. But in reality, he was really burning the candle at both ends. But as a kid, I did not notice. As an adult, really thinking back and talking to him about it, I'm like, How? There's only 24 hours in a day. How did you do all this stuff? Like, did you sleep? I don't understand. So, you know, I think getting older, I have newfound appreciation or gratitude towards my parents, because I understand how hard they work. You know, I guess one thing to hear it, it's one thing to be at that age and also be grinding and just being like, I can't imagine if I had like two kids and was married trying to do all of this as well. You know,
her mom and her dad did their best. They got more education, moved the family to a safer area. But going from the city to the country, that's a big shift, especially when it comes to finding stuff to do for fun. And what kind of stuff were you getting into? What were you doing as kids?
It's not that there was like less to do. We were more isolated though. So luckily me and my brother always got along and were like besties, despite the fact that we're like 3.5 years apart. So we also like weren't really allowed to watch TV a lot as kids. My mom would be like, okay, you're allowed to pick one program. And whenever it was my brother's turn, he'd always pick the Discovery Channel, and it was so boring. But so he and I were kind of just like left to our own devices a lot in the summer. Sometimes my mom would have like, we'd have like friends come over and stuff, or there were these two girls that lived across the street they're at the Rooster House. The Rooster House was their house. I don't even know how they dealt with that, like living right next to it. But like they would walk over, and eventually, like years and years later, I would make best friends with the girl who was across the street in one house over. So, you know, like a casual 5 to 7 minute walk away. And she's still my like oldest best friend to this day.
Running around the woods, riding bikes to the gas station, building forts. It was all about using your imagination to entertain yourself. That's what we did. It's what all us country kids had to do. I remember times where I wasn't cut off from watching TV, but I was definitely forced to stay outside all day and with nothing else to do. And it was those long, boring days that led me and my cousin to do stuff like build a homemade ramp and jump our bikes into the pond. You know, life in the country is different from the city, but it's not boring. You just have different kind of fun. And it's these moments when you're forced to use your imagination like that, things start to build up. You've got all this creative energy, and eventually it has to come out somewhere. When you're a broke kid with no tools but a pencil and paper, you draw.
I did a lot of reading and drawing as a kid, primarily what I did if I if I wasn't thrown outdoors and out there doing stuff. I preferred the indoors, to be honest. I was an indoor cat, I would say, of a child. I never wasn't drawing. I literally, my mom would save and date my childhood drawings. And I actually have a photo of it on my phone. There's a drawing dated when I was like 2 and a half. And I drew a horse with the sun in a cloud for her birthday. So before I even like had conscious memory, I was drawing stuff.
From a young age, Victoria had always had an eye for what was visually satisfying. That instinct would come in handy much later when she was making art for people to hang in their homes and pieces that they would stare at every single day.
I had a lot of like illustrated books I liked, and I tried copying like what I saw in the book. Like I would draw it on the side to try to like figure out how it was drawn. A lot of it was like trying to, like almost like a puzzle I was trying to put together. Like how'd they do that? And why does that look like that? Or just something's really nice to look at. It's very sad. I call it satisfying. There's like a little, it's like a feeling of satisfaction that I get when I look at something that I think is pleasing to my eye. And so I think part of drawing or becoming an artist is I want to recreate that for myself. Like, I want to make the thing that is then satisfying to look at. I consider a painting successful if I sit back at the end and I look at it and I'm like, yeah, that's the stuff. That's nice to look at, you know?
Sadly, growing up for Victoria wasn't all about pen drawings and running around, getting up to shenanigans in the woods. Victoria had some real challenges ahead of her. Ones that would shape how she viewed both life and creativity.
It's actually, I realized as I got older, I sort of had a very strange, like preteen time of my childhood because, you know, I spent an extra lot of time drawing and reading because around seventh grade, my health was never, every year I would like miss a patch of school because I would get really sick with something. But seventh grade, it really took a turn. And I had like very, very severe asthma. And I was always sick with like sinus infections. And that's when they uncovered like, oh, you actually have chronic insomnia. Like, you've never slept a full night in your life. And I was like, what? And they were like, yeah, that's why you're getting sick. Like, one of the reasons you're getting sick all the time. Also, you're allergic to like everything. Like, environmentally, like you've just been sleeping in a vat of all the stuff that you're severely allergic to. And I was like, oh, okay. So it took about 7th grade, 8th grade, 9th grade, 10th grade. Every single year, I miss over 30 days of school. I think that's what my mom told me when she was looking back at the stuff. Every year I missed, like, sprinkled throughout over a month's worth of instruction. And this was, you know, back in 2003, 4, 5, 6, like, if you weren't in school, you didn't know what happened. We had paper textbooks, goddammit. And if you missed school, it was just like, you missed it. So when I would go back to school, I'd just be like, hello, what happened? And then the teacher would give me like all the classwork and I'd be like, okay. So I was always playing a game of catch up. Like, I truly was Sisyphus pushing the boulder up the hill only for it to roll back again.
Victoria loved making art. Like most of us art kids, she preferred staying indoors, but her doctor had other ideas. He said she needed to find a sport, something to help her build up her lung capacity and improve her overall health. So reluctantly, she did as she was told.
While I was very, very asthmatic in all of this, my doctor was like, you have to do some sort of physical activity, sport, something to expand your lung capacity. I was like, I don't want to, because I wasn't a very competitive child. I was like, meh. But my older brother did fencing. And I was like, I guess I'll just do the thing my brother's doing. It's easier for everybody and like whatever, right? So I did it like here and there. I really couldn't do more than 10 minutes worth without having an asthma attack at first. But eventually, though, sort of at the end of my sophomore year of high school, my health had improved, you know, sort of drastically. It was a big deal. And that's when I sort of realized, like, oh, maybe I like fencing. I kind of enjoy this. And then I had a terrible coach for the high school team who told me I would never be good at fencing. And then I was like, you know what, lady? And here's the thing about me. I'm a very spiteful person at heart, which is how you can tell I'm Italian. So I was like, you know what? You don't get to tell me whether or not I'm going to be good at something. You don't get to tell me what I deserve. So then partially out of vengeance, but partially out of just actually being interested in it, I started training really hard because I also my health was allowing it. Like, five days a week and took all these lessons. And eventually, when it came time to apply for colleges, I was applying to art schools, but I was having cold feet about it. Sort of having cold feet. I did a pre-college program at MICA going into my senior year of high school. And while I liked it, I went for illustration. I really thought I was going to be an illustrator. I wasn't sure, no offense to any of the fair listeners listening, but I wasn't sure if art school culture was going to be right for me. And I wasn't terribly interested in being around people that I perceived were more interested in being artists than making art. And I also really liked fencing. It was matching my love for art. So, you know, I knew I wasn't going to make a career out of fencing, but I just thought maybe I want to go to a school where I can do both rather than just one. Because art schools, as a surprise to no one, do not have sports teams typically. So I knew if I went to art school, I was going to have to give up fencing, and I just wasn't ready for it. So in the mail one day, I got a letter from the coach at Brandeis University, and he was like, oh, hello, are you interested in coming to this school and being on the fencing team? And I was like, boy, golly, would I? Really, really out of nowhere. I kind of fell out of the sky and fell into my lap. So I was like, word, okay. They have an art major. They apparently have a really good fencing team. They do. But to this day, they really do. So I was like, I'm going to do that. This is where I'm going to go. So that's where I went.
Finding a college where she can pursue both of her passions? Well, that's got to be a dream come true.
So when I was there, I majored in painting. And I was on the fencing team. I was captain twice. I had to take a year off before my senior year to have surgery on my shoulder. It was crazy. I came back and I did all those things. And it was, really, really formative. I'm glad I went there. You know, I'm really grateful to those professors because a lot of them gave me advice that to this day I use, or at the time, or even years later. You ever get advice where I don't know what that means. But then a bunch of years later, or maybe even 6 months later, you're like, I'm good. Now I get it. That happened. Yeah.
On the surface, her two passions, art and fencing, might seem completely unrelated, but to her, they share a common ground. And the way she approaches both art and fencing, it's actually very similar.
To me, fencing and painting are so similar in that you are solving a puzzle as you're building it. So in fencing, when you're against an opponent, at least the way I fence is I figure out what they're doing and then I try to solve it, right? So even to this day, because spoiler alert, I don't competitively fence anymore, but my other job is I coach fencing. So my style of fencing was always, when I got to a certain point, I will figure out your best move and then I will take it from you. Whatever it is you're best at, I'll solve it, take it from you, and then slowly break apart your game, right? And I feel like painting is the independent version of that. You know, I'm starting with nothing. I have an idea. And so as you're building a painting, it's to me, it is like solving this puzzle. And the most exciting part of painting to me is after you push past the ugly baby phase where it looks terrible, but you're like, this is my baby and I have to love it. I gotta keep going. It's the point where all of the options have narrowed. And so the end result of the painting, you now know that there is only one way this painting can go. You know, you have built it up to this point where the end of it is the only way that it could now be. That's exciting.
the puzzle of making art, that part was way more complicated for Victoria than fencing ever was. She struggled for a long time, like years, with never finishing a painting. Somehow, no matter how hard she tried, it just never turned out how she wanted it to. And this wasn't just a phase. This lasted throughout all of her college years. So when it was time to think about what was next, well, she had no clue.
My mindset truly was just like, if I just work hard enough for long enough, something will happen surely. Which has sort of been the way I've been living my life since, I don't know, forever. That is just like my brother and I call it our like peasant mindset. Because again, my mom's side of the family, we're a bunch of peasants from Sicily. It's just you work like a dog and then eventually something will happen because you've been working for so long. So I didn't have an end goal in mind. When I got to the end of college, I was like, okay, you know, I have this painting major. I think I have to go to graduate school because I knew I was not good enough to get into any shows. My paintings were not good. I mean, they weren't good. It wasn't until like the last month and a half, maybe only month of college that I figured out I'm not an oil painter. I was raised up in oil painting, which I do think did a bunch of good stuff for me, but I couldn't finish a painting. I could not finish a single painting. All my paintings were unfinished. I don't know why they kept giving me A's. Probably because they felt bad for me, because you would see the paintings change. Like, that's the thing about painting. You know if your student did the work, because did your painting change or not? And so my paintings would change, but I couldn't finish them because oil paint took so long to dry, and I just, nothing was working out. Talk about frustration. Talk about constipation. That's where I was living. So I hired a new professor spring semester of my senior year. Her name is Lucy Kim, an amazing artist, by the way. Love her. And I asked for a studio visit with her. I was like, please, can you come to my studio? I need a fresh set of eyes. Like, please, please, please. And she was like, sure. She comes to my senior studio, and I'll never forget it. She was eating a granola bar at the time, and she was just eating it and slowly, it was a Nature Valley bar, and she was eating it and slowly turning, looking through my studio. And then when she got back to the place she started, she had finished her granola bar, and she said to me, I don't think you're an oil painter. And I said, what now? And she was like, I think you're an acrylic painter. She said, I had all these drawings up too. I had my failed paintings and all of these drawings I had done. Some drawings I'd done with, at the time, the big thing was the Prismacolor markers, you know, because Copic wasn't really a thing yet. And I had done all these drawings with like Micron pen and Prismacolor markers. And then I had all these paintings that were like garbage, garbage, garbage. And she had looked at my drawings and she was like, I think you think in layers. She's like, so oil paint is not helpful to you. You need something that dries faster so you can just keep moving through. And I was like, oh my goo, you're a genius. So she left. And then I immediately like kicked open the door of my friend who was in the post-baccalaureate program. And I kicked open the studio door of my friend Shona McAndrew, who was a dear friend to this day. And I was like, Shona, get in my car. We have to go to Blick. I don't know what I'm doing. I have to buy art supplies. And she was like, word, homie.
I think that is a lesson a lot of us could stand to hear, right? Maybe the process you're using or the tools you're using, they're just not for you. Maybe you need to experiment, try something new, instead of just banging your head against the same wall over and over, hoping it's magically going to give. So Victoria and her friend hopped in the car and headed to the art store.
So we went, and Shona advised me on what, because she was also using acrylic paint and watercolor at the time. So she was like, here's what you buy. This is what you do. And so we skipped arm in arm through Blick Art Materials. And I bought all the things and I've never used oil paint again. Like, I gave my oil paints away. I only use acrylic paint because Lucy was right. She was 100% right. That is my medium for me. It changed everything. You know, I'm still a slow painter. I would consider myself quite a slow, meticulous painter, but I can move a lot faster through ideas or colors with acrylic paint.
This is where acrylic paint enters the chat. Her saving grace, finally she could finish a painting. That alone was huge, but she still knew that the style wasn't there yet. Something was still missing. She wasn't ready for the real world, not just yet. So she continued on with school.
That's why I was like, I don't have any paintings really. I finally finished paintings in acrylic. And I feel great, but I'm not ready for graduate school. And like, what am I going to do? If the end goal is graduate school, I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do in the meantime. So I decided to do Brandeis's post-baccalaureate program, right? And it's a really good program, and it was very affordable and extra affordable because I also got a discount for being a Brandeis student. And so for the next year, I was in my first year of post-bac, and oh my God, did I make so many awful, terrible dog shit paintings. They were so bad. They were terrible. It was run like a graduate program. So you had to have a professor in of your choosing every week. And then, you know, they would have visiting artists who would come give a lecture and do studio visits. It really was like the training wheels for a graduate program. So I had all of these well-renowned artists come in and look at these bad paintings and then try to help me. They were all so nice too. We didn't have a single mean person in there. So nice. Trying to help me like figure out how to paint what I really wanted to do. So at the time, I really thought that in order to be considered a serious painter, my paintings had to be serious. Style had to be serious. Like I had to do realism, all this stuff, right? Which was part of the brain block. But I had, you know, who would later become a professor of mine at Boston University, but his name is Richard Ryan. And he came in and I had all my, again, my little drawings on the wall and stuff that were all very cartoony, but my paintings were serious, but they weren't working as well. They were all dying or dead. And he looked at my paintings and he looked at my drawings and he pointed at the drawings and he was like, your paintings should be closer to this. Like, this is what you really want to do. You should do this. And then he left and I was like, I don't know what that man's talking about. But eventually I did build up the confidence to be like, huh, this is a legitimate style of painting.
Sometimes it takes someone, an outside voice, to tell us what's been right in front of us all along. Victoria had been trying to force herself to make the kind of art that she thought that she was supposed to make, instead of the kind of art that she wanted to make. But if she had kept pushing in that direction, she never would have become the artist she is today, the artist that we enjoy so much.
I hit a crisis point. I'm going to tell this story because I feel like this final thing will summarize my headspace at the time. I woke up one morning in my bed, and the first thing I noticed was that my ceiling light was still on. So I was like, oh man, I fell asleep with the light on. That's bad. And then I was like, I still have my shoes on. That's not great. And I was on top of my covers and I was like, wow, I must've been really tired. And then I was like, what is in my mouth? And then as I was spitting it out, I looked over, I was laying on my back. I looked over at my right hand and in my right hand, I was still clenching a half-eaten ham sandwich. I'd been so exhausted. I fell asleep literally eating a ham sandwich. What I spat out of my mouth was, I slept for 8 hours too. I almost died. Was a mouthful of half-chewed ham sandwich. And I was like, I gotta calm the fuck down. I have to just relax, not take this so seriously, and find some time to just, like, unwind. And I'm working myself too hard. And what am I getting for it? Like, a gravestone that just says, you know, died doing what she loved, eating a ham sandwich. That is so tragic. That moment really also changed me. I think I unclenched a bunch and managed to start making paintings that were slightly less bad, or just like it didn't feel as I don't even know the word. It didn't feel so dire anymore. My attitude from there on out was sort of like, I'll figure it out. You know, surely I'll figure it out.
Victoria was always working herself into the ground. And I get why. She felt like she had to. Growing up, I would watch my grandma constantly push my grandfather to always be busy. Even on his days off, he was out there in the yard working on something just to avoid being scrutinized for relaxing. And sure, maybe that mindset comes from love or survival, but let me tell you what, that's not how you build a life. If you keep grinding nonstop, you're going to crash. And when you crash, it's going to be brutal. It'll leave you worse off than if you had just paced yourself from the very beginning. As much as social media wants to sell you on this idea that we're all in some kind of big race, you're not. We don't all start at the same starting line, and we all move at very different speeds. You need to find your speed and stick with it.
You know, I was working so hard in my studio because I really cared, you know, and it was, I think when I was growing up, like the 90s and the early 2000s, and like wasn't cool to show that you like cared about stuff. But I always really cared about things. So I cared a lot about making good paintings. And also because I wasn't getting the satisfaction from having made anything that I thought was good to look at, you know? So I was like constantly chasing that. I think it was Lisa Yeskevich who said on the on a podcast for Talk Art, who described making paintings as maybe sort of like chasing a high. And I do sort of feel that, you know, I'm always sort of chasing that moment of satisfaction, you know, you're just chasing it. And then when you finish the painting, it lasts for a little bit and then you're done and then you make the next one, right? So I was just chasing that, but I wasn't reaching that satisfied level. So, I think that's what drove me to work myself so hard and like sort of constantly be disappointed by what I was making. And I think the ham sandwich incident sort of recalibrated me a little bit.
You talk about not having made any satisfying work to that point, but you still kept at it for years. What was it that kept you going? Was it just that art was the only thing you had ever wanted?
It was never a question. There was no other path. There's no other way to be. You know, it just is. I guess that's the best way I can articulate it. There was never a doubt I would continue because for me, there is nothing else.
The art was trapped in her head and she had to get it out. There was no ifs, no ands, no buts about it.
I've come to realize, I think, maybe the most, the closest word is maybe a compulsion, maybe. When I take a break from making art, I usually get very antsy at a certain point because I'm constantly turning ideas over in my head. I'm making imaginary paintings in my head, but none of them are real or satisfying until I've actually brought it out and made it physical and it's now in the world and I can look at it. So that's what I mean by there is. I didn't have a choice, you know, it just is.
So what was it like when you finally finished a piece, when you were actually satisfied with the work you made, when something, you know, finally clicked?
So the very first acrylic painting I made my senior year, that was the first satisfying painting I made. I think it was maybe an 18 by 24 painting. It came together so quick. And upon completion, I was like, I've never done cocaine, but I assume the feeling must be similar. Like, this is amazing. And so I made another painting after that that came together quickly that felt good. Yeah, I think it was my second year of post-bac that I started making paintings that I felt satisfied by. Or at least, you know, the paintings died less. The probability of me starting a painting and the painting not working out and me just having to abandon it, the percentage went way down. Also, a good thing that I ended up learning from having so many failed paintings at first year was knowing the point at which a painting has turned and it has died. And then also, like, when to stop working on it. Another good piece of advice I got from an artist, I believe her name was Anna Betbees. she looked at all my dying paintings and she said to me, I'm so grateful to her. She was like, you are under no obligation to finish a painting. If you start a painting and you realize this is not going to turn out well, she's like, you don't have to torture yourself. Wipe it and start again. And I was like, oh my God, are you an angel? Like, I needed someone who I considered to be in a place of authority to just tell me that. It's like I needed permission. And that was also sort of a big turning point. I think that and the ham sandwich actually happened pretty close together.
Between her undergrad, post-bac, and the MFA program, Victoria did a lot of school. Now look, these days, an MFA isn't always a must-have if you want to make it as an artist. But for some people, people like Victoria, it can be exactly the right thing. She needed a place where she could throw all of her ideas at the wall and have someone help her see what was already there waiting for her to uncover. That program, it put her painting practice on hyperdrive. It's where she finally found her style that so many of us love today.
So here's what I will say about like MFA programs and stuff. I felt like I definitely needed post-bac because my paintings weren't very strong. And I knew like, okay, it'll be my full-time job to just be in a studio and paint. And that's also the attitude I had with grad school, which is like the accelerate, like you only have a finite amount of time, but because of the demands of the program, you are ripping through painting so fast because that's all you're doing all the every day. I think I took off for Thanksgiving. Like it was crazy. I was just going every single day for it amounted to 4 years because I got into a 2-year program and I did 2 years of post-bac, right? I think it's good for accelerating. I think I did about like 8 years worth of painting in 4 years, given the amount I did.
New York City felt like the next logical step. I mean, that's where you go if you want to be an artist, right? You get a tiny studio apartment, you paint your heart out, and hope someone from a gallery notices. Victoria followed that same path that so many artists have taken before her and made that move to New York. No more school. This was the real world, time to make it happen. Were you nervous moving to the big city when it was time?
I mean, I had Bebe steps to it. You know, Brandeis University was in Waltham, Massachusetts, which, you know, was a suburb-y half city. And then I went to Boston University, which is in Boston. And, you know, I lived in Cambridge and Somerville and all these places sort of like around. Actually, it's not in Boston. It's in Alston. And it doesn't matter. All that stuff is all together. So it is a cityscape, right? And then, I mean, I visited New York a lot as a kid. You know, even if you live in the country of New Jersey, drive an hour, you're in New York City. My dad is from Staten Island. He's very comfortable in the city. We would go in as a family, we walk around and do stuff and see things, and he always knew what was what. So I think from that, I had a confidence about like, yeah, I can move to New York City and do it.
Once you got settled in, and how did things start to unfold?
I mean, it was definitely, you know, art took a back seat. It took a back seat to my job that I got, that I was grossly underpaid for. It took a back seat because of space. You know, you have to find a studio as well if your apartment isn't big enough, which guess what, the apartment wasn't big enough. So as I said before, like I didn't paint for maybe close to a year, and then what I did paint, they were small paintings, but I did feel like making those first paintings out of school felt great because I didn't have to throw them to anybody. You know, not that that was like such a I'm talking like grad school was terrible. It wasn't, but you were hyper aware of all the work you made, like you were going to have to talk about it. So in certain ways, like there was no room for whimsy. You couldn't just go on like a whimsical jaunt and just be like, I don't know, I'm going to paint a cowboy stepping on a snake. And if they're like, why'd you do that? It's not really acceptable to be like, I don't know, I'm figuring it out. Like it seemed cool. You know, that's like not a good enough reason.
She finally got herself a studio, and just like that, the painting began again.
I eventually got a studio and painted in there, and sort of continued an insane schedule of like, I will go into my studio and I will make paintings, and then I will emerge and go to the Mexican restaurant across the street and watch like whatever the Spanish version of like Maury or Jerry Springer is on the TV while I eat. I know just enough Spanish to be like, oh my God. Oh my gosh, she married her own stepfather. Oh my God. Like, and then go back into my windowless studio and paint.
She didn't have a grand plan beyond just making some paintings because, of course, you can't land a show without having a full body of work first.
No, I was just like, if I work hard enough, really something will work out again. The other thing, though, too, that I became aware of is I was like, no one is going to give me jack shit unless I actually have paintings. Because who the fuck am I? I'm nobody, right? No one's just going to walk up to me and be like, hey, I heard you're a painter. Like, let me get... No, you have to have the paintings, right? So I have to have the paintings and then maybe something will happen. But nothing's going to happen unless I make these paintings. So I must now make the paintings.
I think what also initially really drew me to your works is, of course, the cowgirl, cowboy stuff. Because growing up for me, all I ever, like as a kid, all I ever thought I was going to be was a cowboy. And like all I would watch was cowboy shows, like the black and white ones, and dress up as a cowboy and want to be a cowboy. So just anytime I see someone doing something like, and I like what I like about yours is you see a lot of people do Westerns and it's the same thing, but like yours are so, they have that same vibe, but they're so different. They're more cartoony, they're more colorful. And it gives like a hold, but they're still like badass because you still get like the cool smoking and stuff like that.
I mean, I think it's because I'm from New Jersey that they're not like, I don't know, sort of more authentic Westerns. It's my East Coast fantasy of the West in a lot of ways. I think that's part of how they got their aesthetic because it's like it's not an experience that is authentic to me. You know, it's just what I've taken in through media or sort of just like decided looks cool, which, how do I phrase this? I think you could get into a lot of trouble sometimes approaching a visual genre like that. But I was always very mindful of sort of what imagery I used, what context, and always steering it towards, because they're not really about the West, right? They're really about like an emotional internal journey. That is sort of the compass I tried to use to make that series of paintings.
These cowgirl paintings, man, they're everything. They're sad, they're angry, they're joyful. They hold tension and tenderness all at once. Each one feels like an emotional snapshot. They're not just about cowgirls, they're about her, how she felt, who she was, and what she was going through at that moment in her life. And I think that's what makes them hit so hard, is that raw vulnerability, that openness to put her whole self into the work. That's what makes them real.
Oh my goo. All right. Here's the tea. Here's the real tea. And I feel like I've only really alluded to this in like smaller interviews I've done or whatever. But so I moved with a friend of mine from my graduate program. And my boyfriend at the time, who was also in my graduate program, I won't name names, but if you know, you know. And we eventually moved out, the two of us, me and my boyfriend at the time, to a studio apartment. Okay, after living there for like a little bit over a year. And then like, oh man, maybe 3 months into the new lease, he broke up with me out of the blue. And I was like, super devastated at the time. But we still lived together. I had to find another place to live because I was like, I can't afford this rent on my own. He was working at the time and he made like double the amount of money with me. But like, here's what I'll say about this man. He was poison. This person, a little bit after the breakup, I got a little bit of distance and I realized like, oh, this person was like a bad person, you know? You kind of had opposite schedules, so I'd come home from like my job that was also terrible, by the way, and put on either Pride and Prejudice from 2005 or Burlesque starring Cher and Christina Aguilera, and I would smoke a single cigarette out my apartment window and then go to sleep on our futon. And I did that for about a month. That was like my schedule.
Luckily, she didn't have to stay there forever. She found a new place and got the hell out of there.
And then I found another place to live and I moved out. And it was great. And my parents helped me move out. And I was like the Grinch who stole Christmas. How he leaves and he takes everything, including the nail. That was basically me because I owned everything in our apartment. So I left. I actually stored a lot of it with my parents. And then I was living at my new apartment with a married couple whom I loved very much. I thought I was going to live there for a long time, but then the pandemic hit like 2 months later. So my leases were monthly. I skedaddled. I moved back in with my parents in New Jersey. And then I was left alone with my thoughts, which I did not anticipate. You know, you're living in the city, you're doing stuff. I had a studio there. Finally, I was going to work and then I was going to my studio and you're in the city and there's always distractions and you're just moving. And I would basically just go back to my apartment to like lay my skeleton down to sleep. And then I would get back up and go do something. But suddenly I was now at my parents. And those feelings I hadn't really been dealing with because I had other stuff to deal with. And I had, you know, a job I had to report to and all these things.
So she got those feelings out the only way she knew how, by turning them into paintings.
All those things, the relationship, it was really like a post-mortem situation. And I was just like, oh my God, I don't want to think about all this stuff. But I couldn't not, right? So I was like, all right, I'm just going to keep painting. I'm just going to make paintings. And they're going to be about my feelings because that's what paintings are. I'm just going to be here painting in this house with my parents who are worried about me, but it's fine. I made a lot of paintings before I made my first Western painting. But at the time, I was making any painting I wanted. You know, I think grad school was good in a lot of ways, but there's always someone looking at your paintings and then you'd have to talk about them and kind of explain or justify your reasoning.
And the beautiful thing about these pieces, she didn't have to explain them to anyone. There's no expectations, no justifications. She could just paint whatever the hell she wanted. So she painted the West.
The West was a whim. I made one painting of someone just like walking through the desert and stepping on a snake. And I was like, oh, I think I can do something with this. Like, I like the idea of a themed painting, you know? I still do. So then I started making paintings that had like a Western setting. And that's when I sort of figured out, you know, these paintings were a lot about me and my feelings at the time of just like feeling really lost and trying to figure myself out. And a lot of the paintings, I don't know if I pulled it off, but I was really interested in emotions that were a little bit complex or like, at the time, I was blaming myself. I was trying to work my way out of blaming myself for staying in a relationship that was so bad with someone who was so awful to me emotionally. But I felt a lot of guilt and shame around that because I considered myself like a smart, savvy, emotionally intelligent person. And I was like, how did I get bamboozled like that? Like, am I a dumbass? And then through painting and doing like some self-exploration, I finally arrived at like, no, I'm not a dumbass. Just, you know, it'd be like that sometimes. And, you know, you get lured in by somebody who seems nice and good and all those things at the time. But a lot of those paintings, especially the early ones, are me wrestling. Like I have paint. There's literally a painting of a girl wrestling with a giant bird, which is called the Egret of Regret. It's an egret, it's a kind of bird. I think I'm so clever. Like a lot of the paintings are the protagonist like physically struggling with something because I was struggling with stuff at the time, which is very ham-handed as I'm saying it aloud with words. But that's why we make paintings, because it's always feels more nuanced in a visual medium, you know?
What did it feel like once all of that finally came out of your system, once it was out on the canvas?
Well, I mean, there is a purging aspect to it that felt good, but I did end up sending myself to therapy because even making all those paintings, it wasn't quite enough to get underneath what was going on with me. I rolled up to therapy and was like, oh, hello. I've been making all these paintings about stuff. You want to look at them? And she's like, sure. So I sent her a PDF of like, I swear to God, like 45 paintings that I had made over I guess the previous 2 years or something, it was crazy. And I was like, I feel like these explain a lot. And then, so I think going through therapy and doing that also sort of, that was the next leg of my work. It also changed because the pains then became less about shame or guilt. I think some of them got a little bit angrier. Some of them got a little bit calmer.
Making art and having an art career, those are two very different things. Sometimes they can line up perfectly. More often than not, they're in tension with each other. You're either making the work that you love and it's not selling, or you're making the stuff that is selling, but it isn't what you love making anymore. Or maybe you're just plain burned out. Life weighs on you and the motivation to paint starts to disappear. And then something hits you. Something stirs you deep enough to get you off your butt, off the couch, and back into the studio. Victoria once said that she sees both fencing and painting like solving a puzzle. But in fencing, the puzzle was simple. Figure out your opponent's move, block it, win the match, done. But with art, that puzzle's way more complicated. Because when you're making art or chasing any kind of passion, the opponent isn't out there. It's you. It's your own doubts, your own fears, your own perfectionism. And that kind of battle, that's one hell of a lot harder to win. How do you feel about where your art career is heading now? Are you in a place where it feels right?
What career? I don't really know if I have an art career anymore, to be honest. But I think a lot of artists maybe feel that way because there was such a dead zone of no one selling anything. And it's sort of, you know, I could do whatever I want. And if they sell, like, it doesn't matter if they sell or anything. I'd sort of lost sight of that over time of, you know, when your entire livelihood is dependent on a painting selling or not, that it does eventually get into your head. So I made these paintings just being like, it's a big change because I'm putting the West behind me. I was sort of done with all that imagery. I was ready for something new. So I made all these paintings. I think they're good paintings, but then, I was like a little bit burned out. So I was like, okay, I don't have anything lined up. I'm just going to relax a little bit and then see how I feel after a month.
Just as she was taking that break, Victoria was about to face a tragedy.
Around the end of that month, one of my very best friends died in a freak accident. So I took a long time off of painting. I wasn't ready to paint, you know, for the first couple of months. I mean, I couldn't paint. I was functioning, but not well. So I was being very gentle with myself because I was like, I need to eat and sleep. Like those are the most important things now. Like grief really boiled everything down to very basic necessities, right? And then I got to a point where I was like, all my paintings will be about this grief and this like terrible sorrow, a sorrow that is far deeper. Like, I thought I had felt sad before, but I hadn't touched how deep sadness can go. So, you know, I knew that all I would be able to paint about, but I also knew that my eyes would not be ready to see the things that my hands would make. So I allowed myself to just take a break, you know, focus on essential things, watch a lot of Columbo, which is my favorite TV show ever. And, you know, I lived down in the DC area because I moved to be closer to my brother. He has a wonderful wife and two kids. You know, I've been spending a lot of time with them and I would go over there a lot so my brother could try to feed me food that I would barely be able to eat. But again, we're Italian in case you didn't know. So I'm finally, I think in November of last year, I finally started painting again.
If you head over to Victoria's Instagram, you'll notice the shift in her style immediately. And like all of the work we've come to admire from her, These new pieces carry just as much, if not more, emotional weight. She hasn't made a ton of work recently, but that's okay. No one's standing over her shoulder demanding output. She paints when she's ready, and she paints what she wants to paint. And that's exactly why, when she does pick up the brush, it always feels meaningful.
My output hasn't been a lot. I'm working on another painting now. I think I've made maybe this will be my fourth painting, but it is the correct time because I was a little nervous making that first painting because I didn't know how it would feel, but I made it and it felt good. Like I was actually processing what I was going through instead of like reopening a terrible wound. So like that's where I am now is it's not that I don't think, like I don't care about an art career, but it has taken a backseat. Like making art feels important again, but that is very separate from a career, which I, going through this, have realized. Doggedly pursuing shows, it just, right now, it just doesn't feel as important as it used to. Making art feels important again.
When having an art career, making art should always be our main priority, and everything else about that should come second. For art to be truly meaningful, it has to come from a place of love, like all great things do. If you're sitting there right now, comparing yourself to others and feeling overwhelmed by the pressure to do more, just take a step back, slow down, breathe. If you take the time to create honest, meaningful work for yourself, the rest will follow. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the podcast. I really enjoyed my conversation with Victoria. I felt like her openness and her ability to provide texture to the story was incredible. I don't have a lot of guests that are able to provide so much nuance and so much detail about these moments from their past. So that was really incredible. I've worked with Victoria a lot. You might have seen some of the prints we have on the website together, some of the works we've sold together. She's great to work with, makes amazing art, and was super vulnerable for this episode. So I hope that her story has inspired you as much as it inspired me.
The intro music for this episode and for future episodes is provided by my friend, A Kid Named Red. You can expect new music coming from him soon, so stay tuned for that.
Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you in the next one.